Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Over the past couple of months, the electoral map has undergone a dramatic transformation. A pandemic, an economic downturn, and protests over racism have scrambled Senate races that once felt secure for Republicans. Suddenly, Democrats have a real shot at winning control of the Senate in November. This hour, On Point, the fight for the U.S. Senate. And to help kick us off and guide us through the electoral map, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty joins us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hello, Jack. Great to have you.
Hello, Anthony.
And Jack's going to be with us throughout the hour as kind of an analyst guide. And Jack, I want to start with a couple of questions. Throughout this hour, we're going to be dropping down into states here and there where these competitive races are taking place. But set this up for us. What the Democrats need to do to take control of the Senate. Give us a sense of the numbers.
Well, the numbers are 53 Republicans, 47 Democrats. That's including the two independents who vote with the Democrats. Therefore, the Democrats need a minimum of three GOP seats. That is, if Joe Biden wins the presidency, because then the vice president can preside over the Senate. To tell you, you mentioned the dramatic transformation in the map. That's reflected really in the Senate maps. Consider, in January, the Cook Political Report rated four of these Republican seats as toss-ups or leans Republicans. Now, nine. So the trend is strongly toward the Democrats.
Right. So you mentioned if Biden wins, they need to a net of three seats. I gather there's at least one Democratic senator who's vulnerable. Doug Jones in Alabama expected to go down. So that would mean that the Democrats need to win four seats to gain control of the Senate, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And there are pickings in places that have, you know, received publicity. Maine, we're going to talk about it. Colorado, we'll talk about it. But also in unusual places, Kansas. Kansas has been Republican since the Bronze Age, but they have nominated the Republicans there, Kris Kobach, the anti-immigration, voter fraud crusader. He lost going away for the governorship in 2018 to a Democrat. She won easily. And now he's running against Barbara Boulger, a physician and a state senator. And that is that may well be a competitive race because he's such a tainted candidate.
Mm. So give us a list, though. What other states are in play? Give us the sort of short list of the half dozen or so states that are around which control of the Senate will really hinge.
Well, let's just look at the toss-ups in the Cook Political Report. Those are four: Maine, Montana, Colorado, and North Carolina. Sorry, and we're going to be talking about them now. Probably the one to watch the most is Maine, because the incumbent Susan Collins has given hostages to fortune in things that she has said over the last few years, and notably in her vote to confirm Justice Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. That vote looks more politically damaging just in this week when, in an abortion rights case, Justice Kavanaugh voted against abortion, to restrict abortion rights.
Mm-hmm. Jack, what's the, is there one theme that sort of ties these races together that explains why they're suddenly competitive? I mean, obviously, we've talked a lot about President Trump's declining popularity. He's down in a lot of these battleground states. He's down nationally, according to a lot of polls that we've been looking at. Is that the theme that sort of explains why so many of these states are suddenly competitive?
It's hard to find any other one that seems to explain as much. And of course, the president, bundles together all the crises he's facing and all the troubles he has. And that is bound to rub off on some of these candidates. It's too late for them now to separate themselves much from him. They have tried to in the past. Tom Tillis, the Republican senator from North Carolina, has tried a year or so ago, tried to put distance between himself and the president, and that got him a primary opponent. So they've all sort of joined up behind him, and his fortunes seem to be really predictive of theirs. And one thing that's been happening with Senate votes is that they've now split ticket voting. I vote for Republican for president, Democrat for senator, et cetera. That seems to be a thing of the past. So if there's a strong anti-Trump vote coming out in even these toss-up states, that's going to really, really hurt these senators. The old idea of, well, we'll vote for Joe because we know him, maybe not. Not so much today.
Mm. How surprised are you that this is taking place? I mean, as we mentioned at the top, it wasn't long ago that President Trump was running on a strong economy and the Republican majority in the Senate seemed pretty secure. This has come about relatively quickly. But I guess we make that point again and again that, you know, a few weeks in politics can be a lifetime.
Yes, and the months since January, I mean, the country has undergone something it hasn't ever really undergone, the twin economic crisis, the pandemic, the president's erratic performance, the mushrooming, casualty figures from this virus. All of this is hurting the Republican brand deeply, And perhaps things can turn around, but it's beginning to look at like a tough year for them in the presidency. And if a big enough vote comes out there, tough in the Senate, too.
Well, Jack, stand by. We're going to sort of head out across the country and touch down in some of these states, starting in Colorado. Caitlin Kim is a reporter for Colorado Public Radio. She covers politics for Colorado Public Radio, and she joins us now. Caitlin, great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So we want to talk to you about Democrat and former Governor John Hickenlooper, who's challenging Republican Senator Cory Gardner. Hickenlooper has now won that Democratic primary. Sort of lay out what's going on in that race, because he had a little bit of a bumpy month of June, right?
Yeah, he had a tough couple of last weeks in the primary. He was facing a challenge from a more progressive candidate, Andrew Romanoff, who lost. He actually pulled off a larger victory than I think a lot of people were thinking, just given how rocky the last couple of weeks were. But as you've mentioned, John Hickenlooper is a former governor of Colorado. He's very popular, and he's very centrist. He doesn't, you know, you can't really label him as a progressive. And I think that is one of the things that appealed to him running for the Democratic Party. That's why they sort of went after him and sort of recruited him for that seat. He is going to be facing Senator Cory Gardner, the incumbent. And as you and Jack had talked about earlier, one of the tough things about Colorado is the demographics. It's trending bluer and younger, sort of more progressive. And that's going to be a fairly big headwind for Senator Gardner, especially since President Trump lost Colorado in 2016 and remains deeply unpopular with sort of the unaffiliated voters and the Democratic voters in the state.
Mm. Tell us about the significance of this particular race, because as I read sort of all of the coverage of all of these races where there are competitive Senate races, a lot of them sort of come to the conclusion that if the Democrats are going to win control of the Senate, it sort of begins in Colorado or states like Colorado. Do you agree with that?
I would. I mean, I think Colorado and Maine are two of the states that Trump lost, so that already sort of tilts it into, hey, maybe this is a seat that the Democrats could win. I think, as I mentioned before, it's a numbers game for Cory Gardner. There are less registered Republican voters in the state than there were in 2014. There are sort of three large blocks of voters. Unaffiliated voters are the largest block. Then comes Democratic, and then comes Republicans. So the numbers are sort of against him right now. And I think the other thing, you don't want to discount it because Cory Gardner is a good politician, right? He's a scrappy campaigner. It's just that he is going up against a proven Democrat who won statewide twice already and is still popular. So I think it's going to make for a close and competitive race. I wouldn't, bet against one or the other. But I spoke with one person who you know, put it this way. Cory Gardner could run the most perfect campaign and still lose the race.
So what is Hickenlooper's sort of central argument? Is he nationalizing this race and essentially trying to pin Donald Trump's unpopularity on Cory Gardner? Or what's his main pitch?
I think you hit the nail on the head. He is tying Gardner to Trump. And in fact, Trump did that himself at a rally in Colorado Springs in February, where he basically said, Cory Gardner has been with us. He's never wavered. I mean, that's a ready-made Democratic attack line and attack ad as this campaign really sort of revs up, because President Trump is unpopular in Colorado with a large segment of the population. And I think Governor Hickenlooper will be tying Gardner to Trump. That said, you know, John Hickenlooper is not a progressive. He's a very moderate centrist leader. And so you'll see him bring that. That's sort of his main message. He'll be a pragmatic voice in Washington, D.C. And that is something that does appeal to Colorado voters.
Before I let you go, Caitlin, I'd love to ask you quickly about nearby Montana, another competitive state, race between a Republican, Steve Daines, and another former governor, Steve Bullock, a Democrat. I noticed that the Cook Political Report has moved that from leaning Republican to toss-up. Give us a quick sort of take on that race.
I think you're going to see a lot of the same echoes that you saw in Colorado. You have a senator who is going to be tied to President Trump. You have a popular, in Montana's case, a current governor who's done really well sort of with the COVID or the coronavirus response. So he's been sort of center stage, and governors overall have done better, have gotten better ratings on their coronavirus response than President Trump. So you'll still see that. I mean, it's still a Western state, and I don't know the demographics as well as Colorado, the voting demographics, but I think it does trend redder than Colorado does.
All right. Caitlin Kim covers public affairs and politics for Colorado Public Radio. She joined us from Washington, D.C. Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And Jack Beattie is with us. He's On Point News analyst. Listeners, we're talking this hour about some of the key races that will determine which party will take control of the Senate come November. Coming up, we'll head down to North Carolina. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're taking a look at some of the key competitive Senate races that could tip the scales of the Senate majority in November and hand control to Democrats. I'm joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beattie this hour and a number of reporters around the country. And Jack, before the break, we heard from Caitlin Kim talking about Colorado, competitive race there, and Montana. What did you hear in her analysis?
Well, the crucial thing was this was a state that Hillary Clinton took, so it's an uphill climb for the incumbent right there, Cory Gardner. However, he has some issues going for him. Hickenlooper, although he looks like a hardware store salesman in the Midwest that just couldn't seem anybody to look more honest, he's got some ethics issues, and already Gardner is running ads about corruption. It turns out that when he was governor, Hickenlooper violated ethics law by taking a flight on a jet owned by a donor. He was driven around Italy in a Maserati from one place to another on a tour. He accepted off-the-books contributions from a gas fracking company. Then there was an explosion, and he didn't want to make more give more transparency to where other gas pipelines might be. The point is, he's a tarnished candidate in that regard, and also he's made some gaffes. He did at a recent forum. He mentioned he wouldn't go with all. He said all lives matter. Well, of course they all do. But that was an own goal about not saying Black Lives Matter. He did retreat from that. So Gardner has a chance on these local issues.
Really interesting. Well, let's touch down in North Carolina, where Republican Senator Tom Tillis is essentially facing, Cal Cunningham. And I want to bring in Dawn Bumgartner Vaughn. She joins us from North Carolina. She's a government and politics reporter for the News and Observer. Dawn, good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So give us the rundown on what's happening in North Carolina with that race.
So the Senate race is tied to a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's already a big race, but it's a governor's election year, too, and, of course, presidential. So turnout is going to be pretty high. And North Carolina is a state that went for Trump last time and Governor Cooper, the incumbent, who's a Democrat. So Tillis and Cunningham are pretty close in polls. They both have a lot of money. A lot of money is coming in. And so it's hard to say, really, like which one will come out. A lot of it, I think, is tied to voter turnout. A lot is to what people think of the governor's response to coronavirus and, of course, Trump versus Biden.
Right. So Cal Cunningham, I'm looking at the most recent New York Times Siena College poll, is running ahead of Senator Tom Tillis, the incumbent. Mm-hmm. But what's his case? What's he saying about why Senator Tillis needs to be replaced?
So Tillis made pretty clear last summer that he has, you know, hitched his wagon to Trump. And so it's really the tying Tillis to Trump, I think. And then Tillis's campaign, even just during the show, tweeted that, he's got this Fox News op-ed where he talks about how Cunningham, you know, a Democratic majority in the Senate would be this radical socialist agenda. So they're really each pushing, the other sides of why you don't want the party. Cunningham himself is more of a moderate Democrat, I would say. He defeated others in the primary, including a state senator, Erica Smith, an African-American woman. Cunningham and Tillis are both white men. So I think that, some of it is going to be issues, of course, but a lot of it is really going to be tied to the governor's race and the president, I think. Mm.
And what about a response by the Trump administration to the coronavirus? To what extent are concerns around the pandemic and the way that's being dealt with, to what extent is that a factor in this race?
So Governor Cooper our restrictions have gone longer than some other states. And so the first few months of it at the state government level, Republicans were very supportive. Tillis was very supportive of Cooper, which was a surprise where we would get these statements. I guess everybody, was kind of on the same page at the beginning. But Tillis has been really supportive for the most part of the governor's decisions on, the previous stay-at-home order and restrictions and everything. But all of that is changing as a lot of, state bills were filed trying to reopen. And it's very much become much more partisan as far as how you look at reopening. And then Cooper being the incumbent, his challenger in the governor's race is the lieutenant governor, Dan Forrest, who's Republican. And he has been very critical of Cooper's handling of coronavirus. So part of it is going to be, on election day, are people happy with Cooper's response to that and whatever other issues? And of course, party, and they vote for him. And then they decide, well, I'll keep Cooper, but then I'm going to keep Tillis too. And I know that, earlier in the show, there's discussion about, does that happen where you split the ticket by party? And I think that's something that could happen again in North Carolina.
Really interesting. Well, that's Dawn Bumgartner Vaughn. She's a political reporter for the Courier Journal in North Carolina. Dawn, thanks so much for
News
joining
Observer.
Us. I really
thank you.
Oh, sorry about that. I yes, the News and Observer. Sorry
right.
about that. I appreciate that, Dawn. Thank you for joining us. And thank you for that clarification. Jack Beatty, I want to come back to you. The fact that we have a competitive race for the Senate between Senator Tom Tillis and the Democratic challenger Cal Cunningham in North Carolina, what does that tell you about what's going on right now?
Well, North Carolina is a purplish state, so one isn't surprised that it's tight. And Trump's disapproval there, latest poll, is 50%. Biden has a 4-point lead in one recent poll. So the national trends are there, and whether there's – and it all turns, I guess, as Dawn said, on turnout and on mobilization. And we'll have to see what happens. It's interesting that in the Democratic primary, a group linked to Mitch McConnell sponsored a candidate to run against Cunningham. That's how Machiavellian our friend McConnell is. He actually put a sort of plant in the race to perhaps defeat Cunningham or to split the vote. Didn't work.
Really interesting. Jack, I want to go up to the state of Maine. Steve Missler is joining us. He's a politics and government reporter for Maine Public Radio. And we're going to talk there about Sarah Gideon, the House Speaker of the Maine House of Representatives, who's challenging Susan Collins. Steve Missler, are you with us?
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have you. So tell us about this race. Susan Collins, of course, has a reputation as a bit of a Republican who can occasionally go against the Republican orthodoxy, but she's facing a real challenge up there from Sarah Gideon.
Yeah, she is. I mean, Sarah Gideon hasn't won the Democratic nomination yet. The primary is on July 14th, but she's certainly considered the front runner. The National Democrats came in pretty early and backed her, and that led to a slew of endorsements from groups like Emily's List and Planned Parenthood and the League of Conservation Voters. So she has a lot of help behind her, and she's been certainly been bringing in a lot of money. She's considered the front runner to challenge Collins in a general election. And as you pointed out, Collins's reputation and brand as a moderate are really, really being tested here. And I think one of the keys for her to hold on, if she's able to win, will be to somehow resurrect that image of hers, or to at least remind Maine voters of why they've supported her in the past, including in years when Republican presidential nominees have not fared very well. And that includes 2008, which was a Democratic wave year, where she handily beat a challenger who was expected to potentially unseat her.
Mm. So what is Sarah Gideon's main sort of argument for replacing Susan Collins? What's she focusing on?
Well, her main argument is that Susan Collins is not the same Susan Collins that Maine voters have come to know over the years. I mean, she's certainly focusing on the Kavanaugh vote, of course, which, this week's Supreme Court decision provided another opportunity for Gideon's campaign to remind Maine voters about Susan Collins' decisive confirmation vote and that 40-minute speech where she talked about precedent, and then only to have Brett Kavanaugh in his decision earlier this week ignore precedent. Mm-hmm. And so that's obviously grist for the Gideon campaign. The other thing that's been going on is that they're highlighting Collins's vote for the GOP tax cut in 2017, which of course has allowed this lawsuit to proceed that could potentially dismantle the entire Affordable Care Act.
Mm. It seems like this is a really tricky time for Republicans like Susan Collins, who to a certain extent, of course, have Republican support, but they also want to rely on moderate support. So they're sort of stuck in between of not wanting to alienate Trump supporters because they're relying on Trump supporters at the same time to kind of uphold their moderate kind of image. There might be some pressure for them to be a little more forceful in distancing themselves from Donald Trump. But that seems like a really difficult balancing act for someone like Susan Collins.
Yeah, you've nailed it, Anthony. I mean, I think I noticed early on that it kind of felt like this middle ground that Susan Collins has often stood on has been shrinking, especially since the election of Donald Trump, who's a very divisive and polarizing president. And if you remember, Susan Collins did not vote for Donald Trump in 2016. Mm-hmm. She had a very high profile op-ed in The Washington Post, and she went on and did a bunch of interviews to explain why she thought he was unfit for the presidency. Now, the question she's going to be continually confronted with is whether or not she still thinks he's unfit. And she won't say so far. She has not said if she voted for him in the Republican primary. And I think, you know, she may not say one way or the other if she'll support the president going forward. But, you know, because his behavior has not changed any different, you know, is not any different now than it was when he was campaigning in 2016. So it would be hard for her to make the case, I think, that he's a different president, that he's different in the White House than he was as a candidate in 2016.
Steve Missler, stand by because I want to bring Jack Beatty back into this conversation. Jack, I know you've been listening along. What are you hearing in Steve Missler's really excellent analysis of what's going on up in Maine?
Yes, Steve really does put the balancing act that Collins has had to negotiate into clear perspective. And, you know, there's a peculiarity in Maine demographics, as I look at it. It has the highest percentage of women voters in the nation. And that makes the vote for Kavanaugh's appointment, Collins's vote, and this week's and that speech that Steve mentioned, where she said she trusted him, I think, to stay with precedent. And this week he voted against precedent on an abortion case. That really makes that vote so salient, it would seem to me, as does her naivete. I mean, you want senators to be shrewd. But what did she say after she voted to acquit Donald Trump in the Senate? Perhaps he has learned his lesson from trying to enlist Ukraine to help him domestically. And of course, the next day, the president said, my phone call with the Ukrainian president was perfect. He didn't learn his lesson at all.
Interesting. Steve, what about Susan Collins' response to Sarah Gideon's campaign? How is she going after her?
That's a good I think what her campaign is trying to do is a couple of things. One is they want to remind voters that Susan Collins is relevant, especially with the Republican control of the Senate, and therefore she's allowed she's been able to secure funding, whether it's pandemic funding or other pork that would otherwise flow from Washington, whether it's transportation funding, et cetera. She's been really focusing on that. And then coupling that track record, if you will, with what they are trying to portray as Sarah Gideon's inaction during the pandemic. So back in March, the Maine legislature adjourned a month early, otherwise would have adjourned in April. And so Collins's campaign is basically saying that Sarah Gideon is too focused on her Senate race to actually help Mainers get through this pandemic, which might be, allocating federal funding through the CARES Act that could help small businesses. Or other programs that could provide relief through the pandemic, and so they're basically every day there's this social media Sarah Gideon did nothing, and we're over 100 days now. The fact is that the legislature wouldn't be in right now anyway, but there is a chance that it could come back. And the other thing too is that Gideon is not really that well known to Maine voters, so I think Collins has an opportunity to define her in some ways, and so. If Gideon does turn out to be the nominee, I think you'll see a lot of that going forward. She'll focus, as they have in Colorado, Republicans will focus on, ethics violations, which range from not very impactful to some that are, that might turn your nose up a little bit. But the other thing to I would add here, too, is that you mentioned women voters. Well, Democratic voters are on the rise here too. Democrats, for the first time in nearly three decades, have eclipsed their advantage in registered voters here, surpassing even unenrolled voters. And that is a big milestone. Traditionally, unenrolled voters have won the day here and have turned elections.
Wow. Well, Steve Missler from Maine Public Radio talking there about the race for the Senate between Republican Susan Collins and, we presume, Sarah Gideon, the eventual Democratic nominee. Steve Missler, thanks so much for your analysis. Great talking to you today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks, Anthony.
So, Jack Beatty, we're going to move on to other states after a short break, but love to sort of get your sense about another race that you're looking at. What haven't we talked about that's on your mind?
Well, we haven't talked about Kentucky, and that we just learned yesterday that the Amy McGrath, who was the Democratic establishment candidate, won. We learned that a week after the election because of the counting, the delay in counting so many mail-in ballots. And this was a case where she ran against Charles Booker, this man's name, a state representative, and he had tremendous momentum going into the election. In fact, in same-day voting in one county, he beat McGrath by 54 points. The trouble was there were so few same-day voters. And in this way, the voting in advance, the voting by mail, really hurt and stymied Booker's momentum. And as it was, he only lost by a few percentage points, and the progressive vote was split with another candidate, and so he might even have won. So
there's
not a ringing endorsement of Amy McGrath.
Right, and Amy McGrath, of course, taking on Mitch McConnell there, the Senate Republican leader, who still has to be considered the favorite. But there's more I want to ask you about Kentucky, and we're going to come back to that after the break. Listeners, we're discussing the Senate races that are heating up across the country with a great group of state political reporters and our own Jack Beatty. We'll be right back after a brief break. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about on the program the future of the Republican Party. Longtime Republican voters, give us your strategy for the GOP for election 2020 and beyond. How can the party lead effectively and grow? What could the GOP do to appeal to young voters and to voters of color, black and brown voters? Leave us a voicemail with your advice for Republican leadership. That number to call is 617-353-0683. Again, we're going to be talking about the future of the Republican Party. Give us a call at 617-353-0683. Leave a message and get your views on the air. This hour, we're taking a deep dive into some of the most competitive Senate races that will determine which party takes control of the Senate. I'm joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. And Jack, before the break, I'm glad you brought up Kentucky, where Amy McGrath has won the primary there. She's a former Marine fighter pilot. She's challenging Mitch McConnell, Now, it has to be said that this is going to be a tough race. Mitch McConnell will be vying for the seventh term in the Senate, and he begins the general election campaign as the clear favorite. But Jack, the fact that there is a race there and a well-funded Amy McGrath, whether or not she wins, this is significant in the sense that it ties McConnell down to a certain extent to focus on his home state in a way that he hasn't had to in a while.
That's absolutely right. He won't be able to spread his boodle out to other candidates, which he's done in the past, other Senate candidates. Now, McGrath is a even if she were a perfect candidate, it would be a tough race. But she has made gaffe after gaffe. I mean, last summer when she announced her candidacy, she seemed to say that McConnell was an impediment to the Trump agenda and that she would be a better servant of that. Wait a minute, you're running for the Democratic nomination. Then she made things even worse by saying that she would have voted for Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court. She had to walk that back. So she's prone and has made other such mistakes. She's prone to these gaffes, and they seem to go in a certain direction. It's as if she wants to say to Republican voters or conservative voters, I'm really with you, but on the other hand, I don't want to lose the Democratic base. And so she's caught in that sort of straddle. Something similar happened to Alison Grimes, the last person to run against McConnell. She tried to straddle appealing to the Democratic base with, conservative positions. And the result was that McConnell beat her by 15 points.
All right. Well, that's the situation in Kentucky. Jack, I want to move on to Georgia. And joining us now is Tia Mitchell. She joins us from Washington, D.C. She's a Washington correspondent for the Atlanta Constitution. Tia, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to talk about what's going on in your state. Two Senate races, right? Republican Senator David Perdue, Senator Kelly Loeffler, both facing elections. Tell us about these two races and some of the dynamics that are shaping them.
Yes, it's so interesting that, you know, it's the rare instance of both U.S. senators being on the ballot at the same time, but two very different races. So, of course, Senator David Perdue is the senior senator. His initial 6-year term is up. And as a result, he faces John Ossoff in the general election. Ossoff won the Democratic primary, and he's the guy that most folks will remember ran in a special election for the for a congressional seat in 2017, and it became this race with national attention, and he lost to Karen Handel back then.
Right.
And so John Ossoff is back, and again, that's your more traditional, you know, there was a primary with several Democrats, and Ossoff won, and now he faces David Perdue, and so you have that classic race between a Trump-supporting conservative and a Democrat who is, you know, supporting all the bread and butter Democratic issues like Medicaid expansion and women right to choose and all the current social issues.
Right. And Tia, what does the polling suggest? Because back in 2017, that congressional race that John Ossoff was in was pretty competitive. There was a lot of attention focused on it, as you said. Does he have a chance against Perdue, who's rich, former Fortune 500 CEO, Trump supporter, very conservative? Does he have a chance?
Ossoff's people have, of course, circulated a lot of recent polling, internal polling, that shows him in the lead. But there hasn't been, as you can imagine, a lot of general election polling done because Ossoff only recently became the nominee in a head-to-head matchup. But Democrats think he has a good chance. I think that, of course, Perdue hasn't ramped up his race. He did not have an opponent in the primary. Perdue has a lot of money to spend. He has the power of the incumbency, and all of those are things that normally would be in his favor in Georgia. But again, that Donald Trump effect down the ballot is something that even Perdue has said in talking to groups of supporters that Republicans have to stay vigilant. They're going to have to spend money. to retain control of these seats this year.
Really interesting. I'm looking at a headline in the New York Times. The future is blue, not purple. Is this the year Georgia flips? It is surprising. I want to bring Jack Beatty back into this conversation. Jack, another state, Georgia, where not long ago, I think it would have been unthinkable to consider that Republicans might be in trouble. But we're really in a different moment now. What do you think? What are you hearing from Tia?
Well, Tia, I think, shows us a vulnerable senator, surprisingly, and we'll hear even more about the other race. But I've got a question for Tia. Is there a possibility, Tia, that we may not even know who wins in Georgia and therefore, perhaps, which party controls the Senate until after January 5th? What's that scenario?
Well, if the primary that we had in Georgia last month is any indication, it could be days, maybe even a full week before we fully understand the outcome, especially if it's close. And that's, you know, because in Georgia, in many states are embracing mail-in balloting. And Georgia also has this new voter system that they're trying to implement. And then, of course, with all the coronavirus restrictions and social distancing, there was some folks called it a complete mess or a meltdown in Georgia in June. And of course, they're going to try to fix it. We do have a runoff in August that will give an indication whether things are improving in Georgia or not when it comes to how elections are carried out in the state. But no matter what, because there will be so many mail-in ballots, because it takes time to count. And again, when the races are close, as we expect the Ossoff and Purdue race to be, as well as our other Senate race, as you guys said, we'll get to that. But when races are close and you have to, you know, go one by one through these mail-in ballots, it takes time and it's unlikely we'll know on election night.
And what about the the necessity for a candidate winning above 50%? And if there isn't, they have a runoff. And does that happen in January?
So that is for the Loeffler race, the special election, second Senate seat.
I see.
So Ossoff and Purdue is just it's down to them and as well as some third party candidates. But that's going to end at some point after that November election. But Kelly Loeffler is a winner take all race. And of course, she is running for her seat. She's got now competition from Congressman Doug Collins, who had wanted to be appointed. And when the governor didn't appoint him, Loeffler was appointed to replace Johnny Isaacson, who retired. And so
this is a special election. And
that's why you've got
two Senate races in the same cycle.
Yes. Yeah, okay. Loeffler's seat is a special election for the remainder of Isaacson's term. So in theory, whoever wins this seat is still going to, more than likely there will be a runoff because there are so many candidates. You've got Loeffler, you've got Collins, you've got Raphael Warnock, who's a very prominent pastor. He preaches at Martin Luther King's old church. You've got Matt Lieberman, who's Joe Lieberman's son. Those are both the most prominent Democrats in the race. So it's unlikely that any one candidate will get above 50% in November. And so there is a runoff between the top two candidates for January in that race.
Wow. Boy, that is really something, because this could really stretch out for a long, long time. In the maybe this applies to both races, but I'd love to ask you about the influence, the impact of the protests around racial justice that have been all across the country. I mean, how is that affecting these races right now?
I believe, especially on the Democratic side, it's not only energized voters, but it's given the candidates something to stand on, something substantial to stand on, something that is a very clear contrast with Republicans, because as we know across the nation, there aren't as many Republicans who are participating in these demonstrations, who are supporting some of the issues that are being raised by the demonstrations. And so on the other hand, again, I mentioned Reverend Warnock. He has spoken at protests. He has been speaking about these issues for years from the pulpit. So he already has kind of the capital to say, I'm aligned with these. John Ossoff has also been speaking up these issues. And so again, it's for Democrats, these issues align with their political values naturally. So it's a more natural way for them to take advantage. But also they're using it to say, we've heard Stacey Abrams say this. We've heard, you know, prominent Democratic leaders say, yes, be energized in the streets, but also use that energy and go vote.
I'm glad you mentioned Stacey Abrams, because, of course, she came close to being elected governor of Georgia. She's run statewide. What is the Stacey Abrams effect in these two races in terms of the kind of support that she's lending to the Democratic candidates?
So Stacey Abrams is interesting. Of course, she waited in the primary for the Purdue seat. And once John Ossoff won that primary, she endorsed him. But in the special election, she has already endorsed Warnock, even though there are other Democrats in that race. And she has pledged to campaign with both Ossoff and Warnock across the state. And as we know, she continues to be a very popular political figure nationally. And but in Georgia, she's still very popular, particularly among Democrats. And she has pledged not just to campaign with them, but statewide. That was something that was unique or novel about her campaign, is that she campaigned in every county in Georgia, which Georgia has nearly 160 counties. And even the rural ones where Democrats have little chance of winning outright, she said she wanted to get every voter in every pocket. And so she has established a statewide apparatus that she says she will use for Ossoff, Warnock, and Joe Biden, quite frankly.
Tia, I'm wondering, of these two races, which one represents a better opportunity for Democrats? Is it the John Ossoff against David Perdue price, or David Perdue race, or whoever's challenging Kelly Loeffler? What's your gut tell you?
I think the special election, because it's a winner, winner take all, has a better chance of a Democrat getting into that runoff. But Democrats historically in Georgia have not done well in runoffs, because it's about, you know, trying to energize your voters to go back to the polls again. And so that's the concern about the Loeffler seat, is that they think they can get a Democrat into a runoff, but they worry that their voters won't show up again. With the Purdue seat, I think Ossoff, again, right now he's polling really well against Purdue. That's caused, you know, a lot of some of the onlookers have said that puts the seat more at risk than they would have otherwise. That being said, again, Purdue is still a well-funded, well-established incumbent, and it still is leaning Republican. It's an uphill battle for Democrats in both races. But again, I think Perdue and Ossoff probably is their best chance, because Democrats are hoping that if they get their voters to the polls on Election Day in November, they might be able to beat Perdue.
All right. Well, that's Tia Mitchell. She's a Washington correspondent for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, talking about two Senate races down there in Georgia. Tia Mitchell, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, we've got a couple of minutes left. I want to sort of wrap it up with you. We heard Tia Mitchell there talking about the prospects of Democrats in Georgia. It's going to obviously come down to turnout. But the fact that we're even talking about the possibility of Georgia going blue, again, a really significant signal for where we are right now.
Yes, and similar to what we saw in neighboring North Carolina or North Carolina, nearby North Carolina, there seems to be that trend in the state. The Stacey Abrams factor is so interesting, isn't it?
It really is.
Clear that if she had run for one of these seats, she would have been far. I mean, Ossoff, I'm sure, is a good candidate. He's not Stacey Abrams. She was an electrifying candidate, and it would be a bad moment for the Democrats if she's not picked for the vice presidency, and it comes down to that one seat for control of the Senate, and the Republicans hold on to it. That's not a good look. You got to take your chances in politics. She decided to try for the vice presidency. She may get it yet, but it's similar to Beto O'Rourke in Texas. He was a strong contender. He looked like it for a Senate seat. said he went for the presidency. Now Texas is, if not a Republican lock, pretty sure thing. So these are the what ifs of the election.
Lots of what ifs, lots of smart analysis. Jack Beatty, our On Point news analyst, thanks so much for joining us today and helping us sort this out. Interesting times and a lot to follow in the weeks ahead. Thanks for being with us, Jack.
Indeed. Thanks, Anthony.
And listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Melissa Egan, Eileen Amata, Brittany Knotts, Liam Knox, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Dory Scheimer, Tim Skog, Grace Tatter, Adam Waller, and Sydney Wertheim. Thanks for listening. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or Environmental Social Governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.